The following is Dana Chisnell's talk, Deconstructing Delight, Pleasure, Flow, and Meaning, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
This is Bob. You want to know Bob because he's an amazing insurance guy. He just loves insurance. His world is insurance. His whole career has been insurance. And his favorite thing is annuities. Annuities are a thing that you buy into when you're younger so you can take the income out when you're older. It's a pretty simple concept. But we are in denial about the kind of thing that we're going to need for our future selves. And so Bob really wants to disrupt the marketplace of insurance and annuities to sort of make it less stuffy, to make it more approachable, maybe even to make it fun and sexy. This is his dream because he loves it. He's got a great team too. They are in full support of Bob's dream. They want to make something that is amazing and interesting and takes the scariness out of planning for retirement. So as a group, they've decided to make their disruption in the marketplace be a retirement calculator. Now, there are lots of retirement calculators available out on the web, but they wanted theirs to be different. They wanted it to be fun. Yeah. So they tried this, and they invited me to help them do some usability testing. So I'm going to walk you through what this experience is like for users. The idea of Me, Inc. is that you are the boss of your future. So you have a new job. You're the CEO of your future being, your future life. So you get this nice letter, and then you get an awesome desk where the view changes every 5 seconds, because who wouldn't want that? And you navigate through this thing by what's on the desk, you know, the little folders and the calculator and stuff. People actually loved this. You know, they thought it was really clever and cute and unconventional. And that goes a long way to being delightful, right? Little bits of surprise. Next step is to choose some goals for your future self. What do you want to be when you get old? How do you want to spend your time? And so you pick these things. You can see the icons are really sweet, right? And people kept using the word cute about them, even the guys, in a good way. Then you go on to set some priorities. And this is what it looks like after the priorities are set. And the system generates a little mission statement for you, because since you are the boss of your future, as the CEO of Me, Inc., you need a mission statement. And they all end with, I want to not worry about running out of money. All of them do, no matter what priorities you've chosen. So far, so good, right? Everybody loved it. It was fun, it was sexy, and it wasn't scary. And now you get to the reality part, and this is what you get, right? A spreadsheet, basically, with cute script typeface, this far away from Comic Sans, with lots of financial jargon that's not meaningful to normal people. This is broken. This is a fiasco, actually. People stopped at this point and said, I'm done. I don't want to be the boss of my future anymore. The team tried really hard, but they might have appropriated cute for something that cute is not appropriate for, right? There's a time and a place for building in delightful aspects of design, and there's a time and a place when they don't work. Now, really, the first part of this, it wasn't bad. They did a pretty respectable job. And I believe that there's a way to fix this part, too. They're working on it really hard. But we do this kind of stuff all the time, right? And I think that we're in this transition period right now. Everybody's talking about delight and gamification. I am not going to talk any more about gamification today. But we want to move forward. I want to move forward from just doing usability tests that identify frustrations and what's wrong with the UI, what's wrong with an experience, to what's the next step? And I think it's something like positive design. But we're pretty good. We're pretty good at eliminating frustration right now. This, for example, this is on a banking website where you can link two of your accounts so you can transfer stuff between them. This is totally usable. There's nothing wrong with this screen. Everybody can do exactly what they want to do, but there's nothing human about it, right? It's basically putting an interface on the machine. That might be right in this situation. To have a cute little chipmunk dancing, maybe not the right thing here, right? So this is just one example of sort of the range, and financial services is guilty of this, but lots of other domains are too. So thinking about all this stuff, thinking about our moving from just making things not suck anymore to making things good and fun and interesting and pleasurable, I started to look at positive design. Where can we go next? And this, of course, got me to Designing for Delight. It has got lots of us to Designing for Delight, but there's more to delight than the quick hit, cute thing, I think. And I've come up with this framework for talking about it, and it breaks down into these three things: pleasure, flow, and meaning. I'm going to go through each of them. I could spend the whole day talking about this, but we'll give a little survey to what's working and why. I want to back up for a second, though, and give you another example of trying and maybe making it. This is the USA Today weather page. It answers lots of questions. You know, what's the weather like right now? What's the weather going to be later? There are lots of features. If you're a total weather addict, you can, you know, go to lots of features. You can see the latest disaster. Some people are into that. One of the things that I sort of love about this page is that they've made the navigation bar into a rainbow. This is maybe trying a little too hard, maybe in the wrong places. I don't know. But here's usable. Here is answering lots of questions all in one place. Useful, probably. But there's another approach to this, which Sweckit, which answers the question, sweater, jacket, or coat, hence the name, gets to the same thing presented a different way. Not so information rich, but answers the question that you went to the site with, which is, what do I wear when I go outside? Right? And so it answers the same questions that the USA Today site does here. So it has this different kind of navigation. This is on a Mac app. So what is it now? What's it going to be later? What's it going to be tomorrow? But they also know how to have fun with these things. On their iPhone app, you swipe up and down to change the clothes, like a paper doll, on the figure, right? If you sweep left or right, you get a male or a female. You can also sweep further right and get sunglasses for your dog or your cat. They're having fun with this, but it's still useful. It's still answering the question. But they have this really fun aesthetic that they keep using throughout the UI. And so they commemorate these events, and so it brings people back every day to see what kind of new thing is going to happen. But the weather is still there, right? In fact, this is the scroll down view on the Mac app, but if you turn the iPhone app, you get the weather hour by hour, right? Very, very useful. So this is the kind of stuff that shows up in pleasure, in Designing for Pleasure. Both of these sites anticipate the answers, you know, give the answers to the question, but show some consideration of the user for what they want to know next. It's responsive to the context. It's really smart about knowing where you are in the day, where you are in the world. In fact, the iPhone app will find the nearest weather station, which is kind of cool. And, you know, you all kind of giggled when you saw these things. That's sort of the infatuation that you get with this kind of UI. Users feel it. A lot of this comes through visual design, in the case of Sweckit. But when we go to something like TripIt, which you might not think of as a pleasurable experience, it really is. It goes beyond just the visual design to lots of nuance and subtlety in how it delivers a pleasurable experience. For example, it knows that you're there in lots of different ways. It's nice that it shows your profile picture, but it didn't need to do that. There are little bits of thoughtfulness here in that it shows you the trips that you have planned right now, as well as trips of people who you're connected to, who you might need to know the itineraries for. But it's also very easy to share your itinerary with other people. Now, in case you haven't guessed, TripIt is a site where you can consolidate all your travel plans into one master itinerary, and it's really smart about how it does it. So, for example, when you get your confirmation email from Orbitz or whoever, you can just send it to plans@tripit.com and it automatically feeds in. You don't have to type anything up. It's magic. It also has this little treat. And there are things like this throughout the site that this particular map shows you where you've been so far in the calendar year and where your trips are planned for. Now, somebody said to me, oh, that's cool, they're sort of gamifying the UI there, but there's no leaderboard. They're not tracking points so you can compare to the people you're connected to. It's just this little thing, you know, so you can track what you're up to. But it goes on to be like the best travel agent ever. So it offers a map and directions. And then, at exactly the seducible moment, the place when you would really want this, it gives you a little subtle, classy link for something that you might need. In this case, it's an offer for a rental car. Now, what's cool about this, I think, what's elegant about this, is they could have flashed up a big pop-up and obscured everything else on the page to make the offer, but they chose not to do that. And I hope the TripIt continues with this kind of design principle, right? Because this is seriously awesome how this works. Speaking of travel, people who fly on Virgin America, a long-haul airline across the U.S., love it. And how they get to love it is that Virgin has learned its lessons through its own mistakes in the Virgin brand, in the Virgin franchise, and it has watched and listened to the kinds of things people complain about in other airlines. They've made a study of this. They didn't get to this beautiful experience overnight. They've practiced, they've prototyped, they've tried things and failed and moved on until they got to this amazing thing. And I believe that they're still working on great stuff. So one of the things that makes Virgin really different from every other domestic airline in the United States is that it has a seatback entertainment system. Now, that's not special. You know, Delta has that. Everybody has that. But what's special about it is that you, as a passenger, can order whatever food and drink you want whenever you want it. And a smiling flight attendant appears with what you ordered on a little tray and delivers it. And that is really nice. So the passenger is in control, but the cool thing about this, seriously cool thing about this, at least for me, is that that means that that awful drink cart is not moving up and down the aisle, restricting me from going wherever the hell I want, whenever I feel like it, right? So it totally changes the dynamic in the cabin. Now the flight attendants are hosts. They're not servants, right? And the passenger is a guest, not a burden. This manifests in a couple of other ways, too, across the channel, and one of them is through the safety video. I've only ever seen one other safety video that took it this far, or maybe a little bit further, and that's Air New Zealand. But this is a great example of the vision and the attitude and the culture that goes across this organization and how it treats its passengers.
And thanks for flying with Virgin America. A few announcements as we begin our flight. Everyone should have a look at the safety card that is in the seat pocket in front of you. Not only does it have pretty pictures, but it has important information about the location and how to operate all exits and explains other safety features of this airplane. Please keep your seatbelt fastened whenever the seatbelt light is on. To be safe, we recommend your seatbelt stays fastened whenever you're in your seat, just in case there is unexpected turbulence. And please comply with instructions from the in-flight team with regard to the fastened seatbelt signs. For the 0.0001% of you who have never operated a seatbelt before, it works like this. Just insert the metal end into the buckle until it clicks, and pull on the loose end to tighten. To open, lift on the top of the buckle. Be sure the seatbelt fits low and tight across your lap, and you're good to go.
This happens on flights, even with people who are frequent flyers. You can hear people are paying attention to the safety video because they're laughing. And it's a wild experience to see this and hear this. So, you know, what other safety video do you actually pay any attention to? I know for me, as soon as Jeff Smyzik comes up on the screen on the United flight, I'm just like, I'm out of here. But here, they've taken a little bit of an irreverent attitude, and they're having fun, but not at anybody's expense, really, right? And it goes on like this until the very end, where the message really is, we know that flying can feel like a slog, but it really, really doesn't have to. We truly want you to be as safe and comfortable as we can make that be. And I think it comes down to a question that they ask themselves all the time, which is, if I were taking care of this passenger right now, what would they need? What would they want? What would I do? You know, if they showed up in my house, how would I treat them? And I don't think we ask this question often enough when we're designing experiences. So how you know that you're succeeding at designing for pleasure in my framework is that you see it. This is not a thing that's going to show up in A-B testing or multivariate testing or up in the analytics. You've got to watch people and observe what's happening. Now, I saw you all smiling and laughing at the video. This is something that you'll see, right, when you make a UI for a website or something like that, a digital experience, too, if you've really done this well. But you have to be careful, because if you're too cute in the wrong places, it's not going to work. It will just interrupt people on their way to doing things that they're trying to do. So placement and timing is really important. Also, you have to make sure that you're not forcing it. Don't be that guy who just wants to be loved so much that you're in the way, right? Be cool about it, one step at a time. So that's pleasure. The idea is that it's looking at what the customer wants, what the user wants, what the passenger wants, and being there at the next step. Not just getting the person to take the next step, but being there and taking care of them at the next step. You know it? Because they're happy. They feel infatuated. They're smiling. It's all good. You get good stuff out of that. And a lot of this happens through the visual design and the voice of the messaging. The content strategy has got to have a real strategy behind it and how you want to talk to people, what that person's voice, what that persona's voice of the experience is going to be. Which is something that you're not hearing when you get to something like this. You know, when you sit down to write a report or an email or something, this is what you're facing, right? Again, not much on the human scale here. It's a tool. There's nothing wrong with having a tool, but it doesn't help you be productive and get to making that clackety sound of producing words. But there's this great tool called OhmWriter that magically creates a gorgeous environment where all the disruptions are shut out. Notifications are turned off, and it just is there for you to do what you need to do. This is how it works. So you can change the type and the size. Mm-hmm. change the background and the auditory cues. It's just lovely, right? So it's shut everything out, it's created this immersive environment, and that's what happens when you design for flow. This is a great example, I think. So there you are in this safe, lovely place. It's very empowering, and we know that in a beautiful space with a beautiful UI, people are more creative and more productive, and they make better decisions. It creates this gorgeous UI that is sort of automatic to use, right? It's easy to infer very, very quickly what you should do and how you should do it. And so it leaves the user in control of the environment by eliminating a lot of the other things in the environment. It does this through some really subtle things. In fact, I'm sorry to say this, but there are no words in this UI. Not the best thing for an information architect, I guess, but it's an important decision that they made about what this experience was going to be like. Words maybe slow people down, except for the words that they're generating. So there are lots of neat things that reinforce productivity here. Now, another version of flow comes in places like Quora.com. Quora is a website where you can ask questions of anybody in the network, and anybody in the network can answer your questions, and any combination of those things that you can think of. And it tries really, really hard to be the conversation you're going to have after this session out in the hallway that's going to make you want to go have a beer instead of going to the next session after that. It really tries to make that happen, and this is how it does it. So there's a question, of course, this is the heart of it all, but the answers are obviously incredibly important. This is a way for users to demonstrate their knowledge. They get a lot of juice out of this. But the system also generates questions that it thinks are related to this one. It does a pretty freaking good job, actually. This is not curated in any sort of automatic way. There's some human input to how this happens, and it's kind of amazing. This is one of the ways where the serendipity happens, right? Because they're there, sort of in your periphery, and they're really attractive by how they're designed and proximity to the answers and the questions that you're working on. Because then there's something that's related to this thing. It's awesome. There are also lots of people in this network who you can follow. You can just follow them and get what they're talking about into your inbox. Many of the people in Quora are experts in their field, and that is awesome that you can get somebody like that to answer a question that you might have. There's metadata that's applied by users, but it also gets edited. Anybody can edit this. Add tags, take tags away, so that it makes more sense to more people. A continuous design, really. But there are also outlets. Now, I think the original reason for having the outlets to social media like Twitter and Facebook was so you could send your question out into the world and get people to come to Quora to answer it. But what more often happens is people have demonstrated their expertise and they want the answers to go out in the world so they can show how good they are. So Quora is kind of magic this way. It does all these amazing things to make their experience feel frictionless, right? You could just keep going in that space for hours, not feeling lost, but feeling productive, getting useful stuff, meeting interesting people. But it's not the time suck that things like Facebook can feel like. Here's another version of flow, though. These are kitchen utensils from OXO Good Grips. This started with a guy who wanted to make a vegetable peeler that was easier for his wife, who had arthritis in her hands, to use. He slapped a bike handle on a metal peeler, and ended up creating this beautiful line of kitchen utensils. Now, these don't look orthopedic. They're gorgeous. Everybody wants these in their kitchen. But they have great handling. They're the right heft. They're absolutely fit for what they're meant to do. They work really well. They fit into your life very easily, very quickly. So how you do this is all about feedback and affordances that are built in and subtle and automatic. True usability, it's invisible, right? People just do it without thinking about it. It also needs the perception, that is, it needs to make the user feel like it's responsive and quick. It's the right pace, not too slow, not too fast, but it's paying attention. There's nothing extra because you know exactly who your user is and what they're trying to do. And you leave the person in control in their context to do what they're trying to do. You know this is happening because people talk about how productive they felt, how energized they are, how empowered they feel, you know, to get stuff done. They may not use those words, but that's what's going on. In fact, they may even stop talking. In a classic usability test where there are lots of problems in the UI, people stop talking because they're working problems out. In this case, people stop talking because they're one with the UI and good stuff is happening. The only way you can tell that is by watching them. Again, some things to be careful of, though. If you're looking at server logs or analytics and time spent on a page or in a section, this may actually not be flow that you're seeing there. It may be frustration. It may be the wrong thing is going on. And so you have to make sure that what you're doing leaves your person in total control. They can come and go as they please, so that, like on OhmWriter, for example, I'm done with my 750 words for the day. It's time to save the file and go do something else in the real world. It's easy to do that. I know what to do when I need to do it. There are ways of assessing flow, though. This is one of them. This is a quiz that I give at the end of a usability test session, for example. When you're using this thing, this design, do you feel greater awareness? How much does it increase your ability to do the thing that you're trying to do? How much does it expand your capabilities? Does it make you better at this thing that you're trying to do? And does it help you get some perspective? Is there some thing about it that is giving you the bigger picture about what you're doing and how you're doing it? And so that's what I have in mind for flow. It creates this immersive experience where you're just working because everything that makes it a tool is invisible. You just go because everything is lovely and subtle and it's easy to make inferences. Different kind of experience, kind of an amazing experience actually, on the scale of Virgin America is Zipcar. Zipcar is a service where you can rent a car by the hour. Simple concept, but they approached this, they came to this with a mission, a true mission, to generate less waste in the world and make the world greener. But they also feel like they're helping their customers, their members, save money. They're in this business to do good. In fact, flourishing businesses, flourishing organizations are driven by purpose. Not just making the bottom line, but making good. They know how to have fun by being part of the neighborhood that they're in. They're very good at this. But this manifests on the website. In fact, the major interaction that you have with Zipcar is either through the mobile app or on their website. And so it looks nice. You expect that. There's pleasure there. But they do these sweet things like that little guy has a smiley face on him. That's where you are in the neighborhood. And this is the search results. It says, pick me. That's nice. So they've started with pleasure, and they've created a great flow through the site that doesn't feel like it was just a series of tasks that some interaction designer strung together. It just sort of works in a very natural feeling way. But more than that, they've created a situation where you begin to be engaged in a totally different way in this organization from probably anything else that you're engaged in. So every car has a name, for example. Now, this sounds kind of cute, but it's a lot easier to find your car in the lot where it is in the neighborhood from the name than it is from remembering the license plate number that's on it. Right? But it also means that if you use this car a lot in your neighborhood, you sort of start to get attached to it, which means that you also feel responsible for it and responsible to the other people who use your car. There's this sort of co-op thing that happens. And that means that you're doing your part to make the experience for the next person who uses the car good. You know, like you didn't leave it empty and things like that. There are basic rules of engagement, but people don't need to be reminded because there are these subtle things that happen throughout the experience that make it great. Now, part of what makes Zipcar awesome is not just the token community involvement, but continuous community involvement. I get invitations every week to something that's really interesting and important going on. They'll give you a car for free to do Meals on Wheels, but they also have events for members where, you know, you show up to have a drink at the expense of this service that you use, and you end up talking to the other people there about how great Zipcar is and what kind of activities you've been involved in and what you're going to do next. How many organizations can you say that you would go to a nightclub at 5 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon to meet up with other members of this association, of this group, to talk about how great it is? It doesn't happen that often. So Zipcar has created this great experience by understanding that people need to feel like they belong, like they're connected to one another and to the earth. And so there's virtue in that. As a designer, you've got to really understand what you're doing emotionally, right? How you're manipulating, and that's probably what's going on to some extent, what is happening with the person, with the member. Some of that comes through basic persuasive design techniques. Some of it comes through other kinds of behavioral stuff. And here's another example that I want to show you. Wardrobe refashion works in a little bit different way to create community. This appeals to people who are into recycling or upcycling. The idea is that you go to a flea market or to a thrift store and you buy stuff out of the bin and then you make something else out of it because you think you can make something cooler or nicer or you just want to reuse stuff. So there's, you know, ethics and politics and all kinds of interesting philosophy stuff going on here, but what's key to this site is that people share what they've done. There's this massive culture of generosity where people show what they started out with and give the step-by-step instructions for converting what they've done into what they ended up with, all for free, not expecting anything back. They just do it. Now, Kiva.org extends this to an amazing business model. Kiva is a way you can put your money in a global pot that then you can distribute out as microloans to entrepreneurs all over the world. It's kind of a magic thing. How this works, what makes Kiva a great, meaningful experience to be involved in, it's not mechanical. You know, you don't just put your money in and then make a decision about who's going to get your money. There's a lot of involvement and engagement and almost addiction to helping more people do good and make a difference in their communities. And how this happens is it starts with confirming your effort, you know, acknowledging that you've done this thing and that there's progress being made, that your values are really important to this transaction. You get to make some decisions about, are you going to fund women? Are you going to fund things that benefit children? Is it about food or is it about health? Is there a particular area of the world that you really care about and that you want to continue to make better? But the authenticity is built in from the ground up. And this is true of Zipcar, too. This is part of what makes the meaningfulness work throughout the experience. It was the business model from the outset. It wasn't layered on the top. And you can feel this through how the information architecture works and how the flow works on the site. So if you're trying to build meaning in, you can do these things. This is basic interaction design kind of stuff. But it's got to come from the origin of the organization. It has to be built into the culture. When you call Zipcar, the guy is nice, not because he's been trained to be nice, but because he's been selected, because he has this kind of personality. He's been trained, and he's rewarded for having a really great human, nice, productive, forgiving interaction with you. And you feel that all the way across the experience. So when people encounter a meaningful experience like Zipcar or Kiva, this is the kind of thing that they talk about, that they're connected to all these people, that they sort of lose themselves in this because they're grooving on the altruistic part of it. Now, granted, everybody gets benefit out of these things, and there's nothing wrong with that, but people become more empathetic through having these experiences, through belonging and through feeling the community and being engaged, often unwittingly, in these experiences. Now, as I say, you can't just make a tagline that says, you know, we're part of the American experience, or, you know, we're part of every family's memories, or whatever. That's not meaning. Didn't work for Coca-Cola. It's got to be from the bottom up, from the inside out. And it's got to be part of why the organization is doing what it's doing already. There are ways to measure this. Again, you're not going to see this in analytics, but the Gallup CE11 is one way you might do that. A couple of the questions in it have to do with how proud the person is to be part of this and how passionate they are about their involvement. How much will they miss it if it goes away? But the point of designing for meaning is that it's purposeful at every point, not just at the points, but throughout the culture of the organization. Make sense? And so, we come back to the framework. Pleasure, flow, and meaning. I think this is the beginning of a discussion about positive design and where we can possibly go with getting a lot better at what we do, because our customers and their customers are not going to be satisfied anymore with just making things not suck. So when you leave here today, I'd like you to think about where does what you're designing fit in to a beautiful day for your user? What context is your stuff being used, and how can you make that day awesome? I did a whole load of research to get to this. You might want to look at these resources. The slides are available. And I want to thank you very much for coming today. Looks like we have a few minutes for questions. Anybody have questions or comments? My roadie, Jared Spool, will help you with the mic. So the question is, clients are not ready for positive design. Yeah, that's true. My insurance client wasn't really ready for what they were trying to do. They didn't have the culture to support what this little group was doing. And so their failure actually spurred this really interesting conversation inside the company about how to improve the experience that they were offering and how this connected to the rest of the company, because this was just like a little bubble that was out there, you know, a little bubble of goodness that was totally outside the way things normally work there. And so not everybody is ready for this stuff, but you're going to hear from design decision makers, I want it to be delightful, I want it to be fun, I want it to be awesome, I want it to be, you know, innovative. And so there are little steps that you can take to moving that needle. But it's true that most of us, many of us, are still in this spot where we're still not making things suck. And the transition is going to be awkward.
Hi. I'm just wondering if trying to assess flow in interfaces negates the possibility of doing remote methods. So if you're not there in the room with someone, you know, does that mean you can't use remote methods to assess this?
If you're not in the room with someone, can you assess whether they're in flow? I don't know yet. I mean, all of the studies that I've done so far have been in person, and you do get all this great physical feedback from body language. Some of that, I can imagine. I'm about to go do a remote usability test on something that I think is going to be pretty meaningful to people. I'll let you know what happens. You know, does enough come through the phone? Because people do behave differently when you just have voice. They give you more than they do when you're physically present. So call me up in the middle of April and we could talk about that.
Hi, Dana. It seems the examples that you gave all shared aspects of all of the pleasure flow, and can they work separately or do they really work best together?
Can you take pleasure, flow, and meaning apart? I think you can have pleasurable experiences that may not have deep meaning, but I do think that when people feel those kinds of pleasurable experiences, they will attach, and that gives it meaning. I think a lot of teams are going to start out working for pleasure in the design and end up with something great, but it probably will be accidental at first. When I first started thinking about this framework, I did think of it as sort of layers, like you could design for pleasure and you could design for flow and you could design for meaning, and it might be this sort of exercise in attaining nirvana, right? When you got to meaning, you get gold stars. But after thinking about this some more and seeing some more designs, I'm not convinced that that is actually the case. I think there's lots of commingling. And I think flow especially is something that could stand on its own without aspect of meaning. Because you could build a flow-like experience for, say, a call center, right? So you have reps on the phone who, right now, most of them have really crappy systems to work with. They probably even have multiple systems that they're in and out of all the time. But imagine if you could build in flow for them, take away those roadblocks from going from application to application, say, probably they're not going to feel any closer to having a meaningful working experience, but they might. But they will be more productive, and they may be more pleasant on the phone because they have a better experience. Make sense? Okay. I think that our time is up. So thank you very much again.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.